Hello, and welcome back to a special Women's History Month episode of the RC 75th Anniversary Podcast Series. Each of our guests are world-renowned scholars in the fields of Egyptology, Coptic, Islamic, and modern Egyptian history, archaeology, and much more. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find out more about our other programs and activities, including virtual lectures and tours, by visiting our website at rc.org. You can support our work by subscribing to our mailing list, becoming a member, or donating to support this podcast. Today's episode is episode 3 of the 75th Anniversary Series, The Contribution of Women in Research and Egyptology, with Dr. Betsy Bryan, Alexander Badawi Professor Emerita of Egyptian Art and Archaeology at Johns Hopkins University, and Dr. Faiza Heikel, Professor Emerita at the American University in Cairo. This episode is in collaboration with the History of Egypt podcast episode, God's Wives, King's Daughters, and the Princesses of Amarna, featuring RC's very own, Courtney Marks. If you want to listen to the History of Egypt episode, please visit the RC podcast page or on Spotify, Apple, and Google. Thank you to the History of Egypt podcast, and we hope you enjoy both episodes.
I think I got interested in Egypt as a child, and I actually had an aunt who gave me a book for Christmas about Egypt, and at that same time, I was having the opportunity to go to the Virginia Museum in Richmond, Virginia, and see the Egyptian collection there, and they had a burial. It was, and the whole exhibition was set up with this long, dark corridor, and then a right angle to the left, and then a glass window, and then they had the burial inside. So it was all done, you know, in this very dramatic way, which for a child was just unbelievable. I just never wanted to do anything but go there. And my sister and I loved to go to the museum, but she always went to see the Fabergé eggs, and I went to see that. But then, you know, shortly after our first couple of visits where I looked at the mummy a lot, I noticed they had a Naga Der Stela on the wall, and I got completely taken by wanting to know what it said and how to read that. So those were things that never left me, that I just never wanted to do anything else.
Same here. I never wanted to do anything else. To the extent that when I was at school, I used to draw rabbits and things, hieroglyphic signs. One of my colleagues, who was a little bit older, he saw me doing that, told me, "You are going to be good at hieratic." I didn't even know what hieratic was. He told me, "It's just because you like to draw, you know?" And okay, fine. I like to draw, I like the museum. In our family, we were interested, and it was an intellectual family, say this way. My father was a writer as well. My sister was an artist. So, I mean, it was an atmosphere of science, let's put it this way. Well, I grew up and I went to university. We had a lot of field work in those days because we were not that many people. And I loved field work. And in the beginning, I thought I would be an archaeologist. In fact, I am not. I am an Egyptologist. I read text. I'm not a field person so much. And I must say that I didn't mind that. It so happened, you know, when I was sent abroad, I was sent to do philology because I was good at, my professor told me, if somebody is to do philology, it's you. So I did that. I did not believe that in the first place, but you know, I believe in destiny and, you know, the fact that Emory didn't want to take me. Yeah. And then I ended up with Czerny, made me do philology, you know. and then I did a lot of language and a lot of religion. And this has really have been my favorite topics, the written stuff. The literature, the religion, daily life letters, etc. Whatever you can do with the intangible. And in my opinion, the tangible, of course, is very beautiful, and this is what attracts people because this is what they see in the first place, and there is a lot of writing on it, beautiful architecture, beautiful art, etc. I love it. However, I think that the impact of Egypt on the world and on is more intellectual than physical. I think that religion, for example, I was always very, very much impressed by what the ancient Egyptians, who were called polytheistic, in my opinion, were not. In my opinion, they were very spiritual. They had mysticism, and I was very touched by that. And I read many, many texts where they say exactly the same thing as you find in the Bible or in the Quran, literally, exactly the same thing. I was so amazed that I wrote even an article on the matter, with putting in parallel what ancient Egyptian was saying, the power of the world, the invocation of God, and the presence of God with you, etc. How it was in ancient Egypt, how it was in early Christianity, and father of the desert, and how it was later in Islam. So that is something that I'm sure there is continuity and there is transmission. That goes without, I mean, it's too obvious. In the literature also, it's very interesting to see the ethics which are exposed of Egypt, which are so similar to what we have until very recently, until before globalization. Globalization has changed the world. What you find in ancient Egypt, from the human point of view, is amazing, because you realize that 5,000 years before, they were already like what we are today. Human beings, as a human being, does not change. Technology changes, but human beings don't change. This is what my experience told me. And so I think it's a very interesting career. There is endless knowledge, because it is very long, and it's in all fields of all pastures of life. You have art and archaeology and literature and social life, and I don't know what. Everything exists already, and everything has its resonates in the modern world. We have, for example, not only Egyptology, but there is also Egyptomania. Mm-hmm. Egyptomania is something which we don't have except in Egypt. I mean, it's only Egypt which has Egyptomania. We don't have Sinomania or Assyriomania or all that. We doesn't have. So it really shows the impact of Egypt all over the world. There is not a place in the world today where you do not have Egyptomania. It's amazing. You can see it everywhere. And each time you see, for example, in India, they have a place called Hyderabad where they have a complete village reconstructed with Osiris and Isis and Rhea and temples, etc. But of course, it's colored like India. It's appropriated by Indian somehow. In America, needless to say that if you go to Las Vegas, it's it's not very well done, but never mind. But anyway, what I mean to say is that the name of Egypt, the art of Egypt, the influence of Egypt, for example, in the paintings after Napoleon came to Egypt, and on the furniture, on the art, on the jewels, on everything, until today you find it continues, it doesn't stop. So me as an Egyptian, of course, I'm very proud of that. It goes without saying. And it is also very interesting because it is very close to us. And why do we have all this Egyptomania? Because it is so close to human beings. Anybody relates somehow to ancient Egypt, either through his religion or through his beauty to the art or anything like that. It resonates with everybody. So it's really something that is wonderful, and I would recommend everybody to read literature. Don't read the religion, it's too complicated, but read at least the literature. And you will find in the literature of ancient Egypt, of all periods, enough to satisfy you and to make you realize that Egypt continues to exist.
Women have been involved in Egyptology really as long as the field has existed, but in general they were the companions, they were the wives of archaeologists and other scholars. But the thing is that we know a lot more about even those people today than we used to, because they left lots of records of themselves. In many cases, they left diaries, and we know a lot about them because they were right alongside people doing the discoveries. And then, of course, the place I work in Egypt, the Temple of Mut, was excavated by two women at the end of the 19th century. So that certainly was a very early moment. Now, you know, to be fair, when you read the Benson and Gourlay's account of their work, it's very clear that they were directed on where to work and sort of tips for what to do all along by the men who were running the antiquities organization. But you can read in there, you know, their genuine appreciation, because the truth is they hadn't done this before, and this was something they were going to try. And I think that, you know, they hit the jackpot, as it were, because, you know, before long they were finding these caches of statues that, you know, were really quite astonishing. And I think all of the men who had supported them and helped them were happy to see them and help out with the publication of all of that material as well. So, I mean, they have been. Women have been involved in Egyptology for a very, very long time. I don't know enough about other fields to say whether that's unusual or not. Certainly, I think in classics, there are very well-known names of women that go back to early in the 20th century, even in university settings. So, but I don't think that it was very common for women to rise to the level of university professor in Egyptology, certainly not until the last 50 years or so. It happened once in a while, but it was not a common thing at all. And I think that if I can use the University of Chicago as an example, we have to acknowledge that Barbara Mertz, who got her doctorate there in 1952 and wrote an astonishingly wonderful dissertation on royal women's titles, she couldn't get a job as a dog catcher doing Egyptology. There was no chance that they would ever do that. And it continued with Miriam Lichtheim. There was a slow time when, at least in the U.S. and I think in mostly in Europe as well, that the men didn't really want to give up control over professorial roles, but institutions come to terms with that, and the world changes in a way, and so laws and institutions make the changes happen. And so universities found themselves having to include, at least in the United States, that little disclaimer at the end that says, you know, we're an equal opportunity employer. We encourage applications from women and underrepresented minorities. And it has an effect when finally, you know, they get together and they have to choose someone. And you're looking around and you've got a department that's, you know, 10 white guys. It's time for them to be at least one woman, you know, and that was certainly the case in my case, and I assume with you as well.
Yeah.
You're the first, you know, but slowly but surely that barrier really has changed.
If I can comment on women also as well, there were not necessarily women in the field, but there were. For example, the tools that we are using and we cannot do without, Porter and Moss, two women who registered all the discoveries that were done, all the tombs and the scenes on the tombs and everything. You cannot work without these materials. These are tools which are like your arms and legs, you know, and this is done by women, okay? These are two British women. In France, when one of the very early and very, very important women who had a very important role in the archaeology of Egypt is Christiane de Roche-Noblecourt, who was at the head of the salvage of the Nubian monuments. So she was really so active, and I knew her because I worked with her. And incidentally, she was the first person who told me, "I don't like to work with women." So I was very young, but because I spoke French, so it was okay with her. You know, French people like people who speak French.
They do.
So there are, and this was before she started her career, much before becoming the one of the curators. She was the head of the Department of Egyptology in the Louvre, which is quite a big position. And before that, of course, she had a career, and she grew up with this career. And then she represented UNESCO, and she was the one who selected the people who were coming and helping Egypt to survive, to rescue the monuments of Nubia. So women have had a presence in Egyptology very early. They were very few in the beginning, and then they grew up. I mean, in my generation, for example, I have remained the only woman for a while. And when I came back from England and I started teaching at Cairo University, I was the only woman. There were five or six who had been sent abroad to study. I was the only woman. But then, when it started to develop, it developed very quickly. Now we have more women than men in the field. And we have women, my student and friend, Ola Raghizi, is directing the Cairo University excavation in Saqqara, for example. There are women on the in the field everywhere now. And I want to insist on something, because in the West people do not understand that very well. Today you will find women veiled everywhere in the middle of the field, where they come from the south and they work in the north. So all these things which existed in my days when I was young, that the woman has to be home at night, etc., that doesn't exist anymore. It's completely different now. And if you go and visit the labs in the museums, you will find that most of women who are working in the labs in the museum are veiled. And they do excellent job of restoration. And we had the last director of Cairo Museum was a woman. She just left, okay? So, I mean, these are, and they are not just there, but they leave their marks and they do a very good job, precisely because they are women and they want to show that women are working as well as men. So we do not have this feeling in Egypt. I did not, and I know that many people who are working together in Egypt that there is any difference between a man and a woman. They are colleagues. So this is very important for the West to realize that to be closed in one way or another, these are just clothes. It doesn't cover anything else. You go to the Bibliotheca Alexandrina, you find all those who are working on the restoration of manuscripts and papyri and things like that. Many of them are women. It's amazing. It's amazing, really. So the women in the field of Egyptology, including restoration, which is a very major part of Egyptology, many of them are women. Well, men in Egypt, as I was saying yesterday, want to earn more money. And the jobs I am talking about, restoration, etc., are usually governmental positions in the Ministry of Antiquities. And unfortunately, the salaries are not very high, neither for men nor women, since they take the same salary. But very often men would like to have more, and they try to work and to have jobs which are bringing them more money than that. Women are satisfied with less. Not less than men. Again, as I repeat, they are equally paid, but the man, after all, when they get married, the man is supposed to be the head of the family, and it's better if he has money. Yeah? But they help each other, obviously. Mm-hmm. For example, again, I'm trying to correct stereotypes. When you go to Upper Egypt, which we call Sa'id in Arabic, very often people are really in the countryside, whether north or the south, very subdued. It's totally wrong. They are the boss. At home, they are the boss. But in front of people, oh no. All the honors are for the men. In front, in public. But in private, no. They run the show, really.
You know that. Huh? Women run the house, and nobody's going to tell them what to do.
They are Nebet Peri in hieroglyphics, they are the mistress of the house. It's a title. Sitt al-Bayt in Arabic, we say. The
yep.
And that comes from ancient Egypt. It's exact translation. She's called Sitt al-Bayt, the mistress of the house.
Mm-hmm. I was trying to speak both from my experience of how I taught and how Richard and I have taught together as a team, but also what I consider to be the most important things to teach and why. So I'm very devoted to the fact that, and very privileged to have always had really great students, Johns Hopkins and like American University in Cairo. We get super smart students, both as undergraduates and graduate students. And so they can really pretty much do anything you want them to do. And the thing is, I've worried a little bit that teaching our discipline is becoming a little lazy, and that there is a tendency to teach seminars that are more theoretical, that are really about almost quasi-political topics like colonialism or things of this nature. And I'm all in favor of that, but it has to be with first a true foundation of what we know about ancient and up to the modern time of Egypt. And that means that people should not be talking about it with any kind of seriousness in the classroom without having that. And so I really believe that the role, at least of an Egyptologist who studies ancient Egypt, is to teach the language, the history, and the material culture in exactly the same way you would teach grammatically. The way you would teach language is the way I teach art history, for example. I mean, they need to learn. They need to have instant recall of enormous amounts of information.
Absolutely.
Because what happens one day, you find yourself on an excavation and something is found. You have uncovered something. What are your tools for understanding what it is that you have uncovered? So I believe strongly, you know, that all of that interpretive stuff should wait a bit, and students should really have periods where they are packing themselves with the tools to actually do analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And then those seminars are just ever so much more exciting, and they will actually bring about real change, real thought, intellectual notions that are then applied to this material. It's going to be a whole lot more productive.
And my idea was, of course, they have to have some knowledge and some rules to start. I mean, you can't just start with nothing. But then as soon as they have this, I want them to give their opinion, not to repeat. So in order to do that, you have to be able to speak a language that, I mean, if you are teaching them in English and they don't understand English, it's not their job. I mean, it's not a must. And of course, afterwards it becomes a must because you have to read. You have to read references, you have to read the textbooks, etc. But firstly, you have to have some foundation in Egyptian, in Arabic first, and then you do the rest of it. That was my impression. And also, don't forget that these people, particularly when they come from countryside, they live the culture. I lived the culture. I did not know that there were transmission of culture until I observed it. Normally, you don't observe your own culture. You live it. But then when I went abroad and I read the text, and then I realized that what is written in the Egyptian text is what I see in my life, I said, well, I have to go into that. I have to understand that very well. And I must tell you that also when I, Egypt went through difficult situations because it went through very many wars. And after 67, the psychology of people were very, very low. So one of the things I thought would be raising their morale would be their knowledge of ancient Egypt. Their knowledge that they have done, their ancestors have done this and this and that, so should you, so you can. And I thought that worked in a way, you know, somehow you have to have dreams and you have to have self-confidence. And without that, you go nowhere. So this is one other reason why I say, well, know yourself first. Know yourself and know how much you have contributed to the world so that you can realize that you are able to do it.
I think that's really very wise.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important to me as well that we recognize that as an instructor with students, that they are also coming with their own ideas and they're bringing a lot to this with a lot of excitement and hope. And we have to help them realize the ideas that they come in there and bring with them and not smash those beliefs. Because I have seen professors who just really want to talk. They just want to hear themselves talk and force the students to do everything that they do exactly the way they do it, etc. And that's not how I think any professor should behave, regardless of how important you are.
I agree 100%. There's something I would like to add also. I believe that the best Egyptology you can have is if you have a team where you have Egyptians and foreigners. And for the following reason, because for a very long time in my life, I did not write about transmission or anything like that because I would say, but everybody knows that. It's obvious everybody knows that. And then I realized that nobody knew it. Nobody knew it, so I said, when I realized that nobody knew it, I started working on it. And I realized that if I have my counterpart is a foreigner, he or she will ask me, will see things I haven't seen, because for me it's obvious. See what I mean? So they can draw my attention to something I didn't give much attention for, and I can explain to them things they don't understand, because this is my culture. This is my, in the language is very, very obvious. As I was telling you the other day, Professor Posner, the story, it's not the only case. I have seen many texts and I said, this is wrong. And sometimes the person who translated it was a big professor, and he himself said, I don't understand what they say. So I would think it in Arabic and know what it means, because it's exactly as we say it in Arabic. So the combination of the two, one showing to the other something that he didn't pay attention for, and the other one correcting it. I think it's the ideal team. And it's very important that you trust also your workers. You learn a lot from your workers.
Yes.
A lot. Mm-hmm. They know, they have experience.
They really know.
Yeah. Well, I think it's not only the language, it's also material culture. Sometimes you get something out of the earth, and then it's exactly the same thing that the peasants are still using. For example, the oven.
Right.
Bread baking. It's exactly the same thing. I mean, if you don't know, ask the worker who is working with you, and he will explain to you.
Right. No, that's very true. And I can't say how many times on an excavation, when we're working and something is coming up, and the gufti will recognize what it is way before anyone else and tell us.
Yes.
And it turns out to be correct, because of exactly what you said, that it's something that looks and is used in exactly the same way.
By the way, I don't know whether you understand the word gufti. Gufti, we use it very freely,
yeah.
But the gufti is a person who comes from Qift. Qift is a city, and people of Qift have been trained from a very long time. By foreign archaeologists, and then they pass on their knowledge to their children, and there are families of people who are coming from Qift, that's what they call Gufti, and their children are still doing the same thing. So they have it in their blood,
Very true.
But a lot of things which have been transmitted are traditions. Funerary traditions, for example, superstitions, which are still existing in Cairo. And I think that women have something to do with the transmission of superstition, more than men. Because men are more exposed to development. Women are very often at home, raising their kids, etc. So the traditions remain because of women and because of the fact that they're not as exposed. I remember at some point, maybe 20 years ago or something, maybe 30 years ago, I went to Luxor and my daughter was there with me. She was a student at Cairo University doing also archaeology and restoration, and she stayed by herself. People were so astonished that she was a young girl and staying by herself in Karnak in one of the houses of the French team there, and they were very surprised. And when she came back, she was just as surprised. She told me, can you believe that women in Karnak and people in Karnak have never been to Luxor.
Right.
It's only 2 kilometers
right.
Between Karnak and Luxor. 2 kilometers. They have never been there. So it's the discrepancies that existed between the educated and non-educated people in Egypt is very, and still is, by the way.
It is.
Still is very,
that's
very
the gap
big.
That has to be filled,
yeah.
And closed.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's not just literacy or any of those things. It's really just
exposure.
An exposure to something
exposure.
Other than the four walls that you live in. And that's really what produces people who do have way too blinded a view of the world. Same here in the United States, you know, and I wish I could say it was better here because it's gotten worse than, but.
Mm. But I think that television is repairing a little bit. Television shows them things that they would have never known before.
Yeah.
Good and bad. Mm. Mm. So what I'm telling you, this is, I mean, things have changed a lot in the last 30 years. A lot, really. I tell you, particularly for women, because they were invisible and now they are very visible.
Yeah.
And what I like, actually, in Egypt, more than in other Arab countries, that, you know, in ancient Egypt, the woman was very strong and very independent financially, economically, etc. And I think all this remains in the history of a country. I mean, Egyptian women are strong, really. You know, at all the level of the society, they are really strong. Whenever there was a revolution or demonstration, half of the people there were women,
mm-hmm.
more than, so women are strong.
You just listened to the contribution of women in research in Egyptology with Dr. Betsy Bryan and Dr. Faiza Heichel. If you haven't already, please head over to the RC podcast page and listen to the collaboration episode with the History of Egypt podcast, God's Wives, King's Daughters, and the Princesses of Amarna, featuring RC's Courtney Marks. Please visit our website at www.rc.org/podcast for more information or contact us at podcast@rc.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.